Hey, y'all, I'm Paula Jane. I'm an addict. And it is, it's always an honor to be asked to do anything for the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, because I feel like, as a member of this fellowship, that's my job, to do whatever I can to keep our fellowship alive and free. And to even be asked is an honor. And like I said, I try to do whatever I can for the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you, Ralph. Man, thank you. Thank you so much of what he said really hit home with me. And I remember last, several months ago, I was, listen, y'all, I became manager of a halfway house for women when I had 5 months clean. And you talk about a chance to practice principles before personalities every day from sunup to sundown. But anyway, one of the women from the house, I had drug her along with me, and we went to my home group, and it was just the two of us. You know, we had the doors open and we couldn't do coffee because of the church regulations or whatever. But we're sitting there, you know, and she was like kind of pissing and moaning, you know, about we're the only two here. I said, look, baby, don't get it twisted. We ain't here for us. We're here to keep the doors open in case some newcomer shows up and needs Narcotics Anonymous. That's why we're here. So don't get it twisted. But anyway, I am... I'm what they call a low bottom addict. I did some shit. I have a very, very interesting criminal background. I have, yes, a total of 9 felonies. And listen, the weird thing about that is every one of those, now I never got a paraphernalia charge. I didn't get no doggone possession charge. But all that other stuff was as a direct result of my drug addiction. Forgery, theft of property, and then robbery, you know, all as a result, because I had a bad, when I was using, I would do whatever I had to do, and I had a bad habit of taking other people's shit. Right. And in fact, back in 2014, when I got those last 2 felonies, my brother, bless his heart, he was helping the detectives here at Barker, and they ran my pawn shop record, and the detective told my brother, said, well, I ran your sister's pawn shop record. And I must say, it's one of the most impressive I've ever seen in all my years. As a matter of fact, I was coming out here tonight, and I realized where I was, and I thought, oh, my God, I remember being released from the Bartlett jail in January of 2014. Y'all, that was the coldest Christmas we'd had in 35 years. And I had gotten arrested from my folks' house out in Bartlett. Anyway, I was released, and I had enough money to buy a pack of cigarettes. So I went over to Kroger and got me a pack of cigarettes and stole me some matches. So, you know, I did what I had to do, y'all. I don't know if y'all can relate to that. But anyway, and I called my family. You know, my sons were at my folks' house out in Bartlett. And I called and I asked my oldest son to come pick me up. And guess what he said? Don't hold your breath. You know, don't hold your breath. Because I was one of those kind of dope fiends that I was not going to stop doing what I was doing as long as I had somebody to put cotton balls under my behind.
That's right.
As long as I had that back door. As long as I had somebody to come and put money on my books or whatever. I remember one time, I did like 3 weeks at jail East on a $250 bond, and we're sitting around bullshitting one day, and one of the girls said, $250 bond? Your folks had only have to pay $68 to get you out. I said, baby, you don't understand. My family wouldn't pay 68 cents. I said, and you know what? I can't blame them. I wasn't mad at them. But anyway, I got out of jail that morning and called my family, and they said, don't hold your breath. So, you know, my little mind starts working, and I'm sitting there in the Kroger looking around, you know, evaluating everybody, trying to figure out who I can run up on. Yeah, and I did. I ran up on this young lady who was there waiting on her sister, who was there on a job interview. So I talked to her, you know, and they were going to give me a ride back to Memphis. And I'd already been on the phone with that trick down in Tunica, and he had wired me $35, you know, so I'm good. I'm golden. I get back to Memphis. Now, keep in mind, it's cold as hell out there. And I've had on, like, a little light jacket from Walmart. It's cold as hell. I had nowhere to go, but I had $35. Y'all know what? I had those young ladies drop me off close to the dope man. Went and did what I did, got what I had to have. And instead of trying to figure out some way to put a roof over my head, and that night, I spent the night up in the corner in the emergency room, waiting room at Methodist Hospital, nodded out over in the corner. You know, under my jacket, you know, hoping that the security guard won't realize I ain't supposed to be there, you know. And then the next morning, I went from there. And about a week, about a month later, I got arrested. And it was so funny. I mean, I knew the folks were coming. I knew they was coming. So I hear that on the door of that broke down ass trailer. And I don't know if y'all were ever familiar with Lawson's Trailer Park there at Watkins and Chelsea. Oh, love. That's out the sordid place that I went to. Anyway, I opened the door and there's a deputy standing there at the bottom of the steps with my picture. And he says, "You know why we're here?" I said, "I sure do, fellas. Come on in. Let me glue in my teeth and let's roll." And the chick that I had been holding up with, she was wanting to know my R&I number, but I just rattled it off right off the top of my head. And that officer said, "Damn, you have been to jail a few times. You know your R&I number just like that." I said, "As well as I know my birthday, okay?" But anyway, I did not know for a long time that my life was unmanageable. Because I call my disease slick. If you know me very well at all, if you heard me talk to me, I call it slick. Well, you know, as a little girl, I came home from school one day. I was the second of four children. I had an older brother and two younger brothers. I was the only girl. And yeah, I was a tomboy because, listen, hanging around in the house with mama, cooking and cleaning house was not no fun. But riding motorcycles and going to the woods and swinging on grapevines and building tree houses, that was fun. So that's what I did. But anyway, my mother said I came home when I was in the third grade, just announced to her that I was going to be a nurse. It really didn't make any sense because none of my relatives were nurses. None of my mama's friends were nurses. You know, we didn't watch soap operas, you know, with the nurse in the little short skirt, you know, bent over in front of the doctor and all that type of stuff. So I don't know where that came from, but as a young girl, that's all I ever wanted to be. But I also, y'all, I'm one of those people that says in our basic text, some of us believe our disease was present long before we ever used. I know I'm one of those people. I know it. I was born with this state of disease, you know, even though probably 75% of the people I graduated from high school with, I had grown up with. You know, my folks bought a house down in Oak Haven about a mile and a half east of the airport in 1958. And it was a baby, you know, a baby boomer, you know. And that was back in the day when a father could make enough money to support a wife and two or three, even four youngins, you know. So I grew up with these people. We grew up together, but I never felt a part of. I always felt different. And I became like a chameleon, you know. I could kind of hang out with different groups and feel sort of comfortable, but not really. Never really felt like I fit in. And, you know, kids are very, very intuitive, and even a budding little drug addict like me, very sensitive. I knew there was something wrong in my family. I knew my mother was unhappy. I just didn't know why, you know. But I did know that my father was a raging, unpredictable alcoholic, you know. And so even though he quit drinking when I was a little girl, he, about 5 or 6 years old, he switches addiction to other women and things. But that's a whole other story. But anyway, so I became, I don't know if any of y'all have had therapy. Through the years, I've had a buttload of therapy, okay? Now, there's this theory about roles in the family. The first one's the hero child, and then you got the mascot child, and then the scapegoat, blah, blah, blah. I was the mascot child. It was my job to keep everybody laughing and entertain, you know, so that we don't pay attention to the big elephant in the room, which is the violent, unpredictable alcoholic. But anyway, so there I was, and I went to nursing school after high school, and I found this delightful guy And I was a budding drug addict, and he was a budding codependent. He was looking for somebody to take care of, and guess what? We got married, you know, after a while. And I had gone to nursing school for a year right after high school, but I quit because I discovered drinking and partying and hanging around with guys. I was what they call a late bloomer, okay? I'm a late bloomer in a lot of things in my life, but... But when I did, that first magic potion that I found was that liquid. And y'all, most people do not remember with clarity the very moment that they ever took a liquid or a powder or a pill. I remember it like it was yesterday because I remember how that felt. It was boom. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Boom. Oh yeah. And man, I'll tell you what, as a matter of fact, I took dancing the whole time I was in high school. And as a matter of fact, we were backstage, it was our recital, and I kept going back to my teacher's husband. He's the one that gave me that first sip. That by the time the finale came around, baby, I was cooking. I wasn't drunk, but man, did I feel good. Anyway, I went to nursing school for 2 semesters, discovered drinking and partying, and really, for real, dropped out and didn't go back for another 9 years. And I actually did. I was a nurse, and I worked for a number of years. We had 2 children, 2 sons, and bought a home and did all that stuff. But, you know, I did not realize until I started working the steps how really selfish and self-centered I really was. And I started going to treatment. Oh, I'm one of those folks. My hat's off to folks that go to the treatment one time and stay clean. God love you. I was not one of those people. A couple of years ago, my brother and his wife, my brother's the only member of my family of origin that I have left. A couple of years ago, my brother and his wife, I was over there visiting. He said, well, sis, Laura and I were having a debate. We were trying to decide if you had been to treatment 13 or 14 times. I said, well, whoever said 13 times wins the prize, you know. Anyway, I started going to treatment in 1986 and then went back in 89 and blah, blah, blah. And I eventually lost my nursing license, by the way. I didn't lose it. I gave it away because you know what? Another thing about Slick, everything that I told Slick I would never, ever, ever do, guess what? I did it. I said I would never use drugs on the job. I would never steal drugs from the hospital. I would never be unfaithful to my husband. I would never abandon my children. I wouldn't do this and I wouldn't do that. Everything that I told Slick I wouldn't do, I did. You know, you heard the expression, I hadn't done that yet. You're eligible too. My list of yets is mighty short, y'all. Mighty short. Anyway, so in 1991, I had been to treatment at Lakeside and oh boy, in the impaired professional program. Oh my God, y'all, they gave me like 2 whole days worth of psychological tests and then took me in the therapist's office to give me the results and told me that I was selfish. And I remember being thoroughly insulted. What do you mean selfish? I'm one of the most giving people I know, you know? And it wasn't until years later, you know, and doing some step work that I realized, yeah, I was selfish and self-centered to the core. Yeah, I'm going to do something for you, but I'm setting you up for the okey-doke. You know, that means I'm going to get back as the time is going to come and I'm going to expect you to do something for me, you know. And even as a little girl, I did that because another thing I discovered, y'all, through doing step work is I had this intense fear of abandonment, you know. And this feeling that not only that my best wasn't good enough, it went deeper than that. Somehow I wasn't good enough, you know. That's what it was. But anyway, in 91, I made the decision that I was going to get a divorce. So I came home from work that night I stopped and got me a pack of Cool Miles. I had not been smoking for years. I stopped and got me a pack of Cool Miles, and I came home and turned off the TV and told my husband that I had made up my mind I was getting a divorce and he was going to have to get somewhere. There was no discussion, you know, none of that was. And I did not even think, y'all, at the time. If it ever crossed my mind, I'm sure I dismissed it, but I don't even remember at the time thinking what effect that was going to have on our sons or my husband. You know, what that was going to do to him, because at that time it was all about me. It was all about me. And divorced my husband, and I stayed in the house with our two sons for a couple of years. And then in the summer of 94, I got introduced to that stuff. You know, that stuff. And in 6 months, I was about to lose the home. So I contacted my ex-husband, and he moved in and stayed. He moved in the house where I had been with our sons, you know, since I sent him off. And he moved in to maintain a home for our sons, and he stayed there until just 3 or 4 years ago, you know. And that's certainly something that I never thought I would do. You know, it was very difficult for me to accept the fact that I had abandoned my sons, you know. I had abandoned my sons, and for years after that, I could not even go to the house where they lived without being overwhelmed by that shame and guilt and remorse. And I would go use over it, you know. And then y'all, it got to where there wasn't enough dope in this city to numb that kind of pain. And then guess what, y'all? I used that as an excuse to keep on using. Because, and let me say this, I know where I belong. When I was at the, you know, that, oh, and I was at that halfway house for women almost 3 years, 1 month shy of 3 years. And those ladies had come in. I said, well, what fellowship do you belong in? I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I said, oh, hell no. Don't be an anda. I'm not a fruit and a banana. I know who and what I am.
Right.
I know where I belong. Now, my drug of choice. Listen, Twinkers and those Go Fast people, y'all wear me completely out. I cannot take it. I like the opiates and the benzos. I like to lay around, nod, scratch, and listen to music, eat sweets, you know, smoke cigarettes, look at TV, you know, stuff like that. Go Fast people wear me out. But anyway, I know where I belong, because not only I love it, and I love our literature. Because see, for me, if I'm in a fellowship and I'm reading their literature and I got to change the words to make it fit me, I got the wrong book.
Right. Okay.
I got the wrong damn book. The basic text, it works how and why, you know, whatever, living clean, yeah, even the guiding principles. I don't have to change a word. It fits me right down to the ground. Because I'm an addict. My problem is not a specific substance. It is a disease called addiction. You know? So I'm grateful to know where I belong. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. I got off on a tangent. But, you know, a little over 3 years ago, I had, in June of 2016, I moved into this cute little duplex over in High Point. And I was in the fellowship with the thirsty people. And God love them. I love those folks. They are our predecessors, and I'm grateful to them. In fact, the job that I have now, I've started doing a literature study. We've just finished their 164 pages, and we're getting ready to start on the basic text, too. You know, right. Because, listen, all those treatment centers that I went in, they did not give NA an equal time. You know, and it's just the way it is. We don't get equal time, but so I'm trying to rectify that in the facility where I work. But anyway, and still again, I'm just like, anyway, that little house that I had was hanging out with the thirsty people, and I forgot, y'all, that I was powerless over opiates. I thought I could just slip off, you know, and do it, you know, every now and then, and in no time at all, everything I had in that little duplex was just heroin coupons. You know, it was all heroin coupons. And I ended up going to stay out in Fraser. And oh my God, I had never actually stayed in Fraser before. God, it was hideous. Listen, because okay, June of 2017, I was driving a car that actually belonged to my sister-in-law's dead father. They were letting me drive it, and one minute I was standing at the counter buying a pack of cigarettes. The next minute I'm in the back of an ambulance. Okay, and the doors of the ambulance were open, and I grew up in Memphis. I knew where I was. I was at North Parkway and East Parkway at the Hop Inn. I'm like, what the hell happened? Well, you crashed into a pole, you know. Like, oh my God. Anyway, I had gone. Listen, because this is how bad. If I wanted some dope, I was going to do whatever I had to do to get it. A couple of years ago, I was working for this guy that owns a cab company, and he also has a Tote the Note car lot. And I was clean, like going on almost a year. And I said something to him one day about, boss, I maybe need to talk to you for too long about getting me a car. And he knew I was in recovery, and he was more familiar with the thirsty people because he'd ask me periodically about my sobriety, and I didn't correct him. I just talked to him, you know. And I said, I may need to get you to get me a car. And he said, ooh, if you get a car, that's not going to make you want to go get something, is it? I said, boss, you don't understand. If I decide I want to go get something, I will steal your son's bicycle or your old lady's car or whatever. I will walk, hitchhike, take a bus, whatever I got to do to go get something. No, it's not, you know, that's not an issue. But anyway, I lost that little duplex, and I ended up staying with some dope fiends out in Fraser. The house was owned by this 81-year-old man who was a retired sheriff's department deputy. And I don't know what his deal was, but he was the only one on the place that wasn't doing some kind of dope. The rest of us were doing it every day. And during those 10 months, I had the ambulance called on me 3 times. And but for the grace of God, that's what I call my higher power, God. But for the grace of my higher power, I would not even be here today, much less be clean, you know. And my clean date is July 23rd of 2018. And even though that's only 41 months, I am not confused about who and what I am. I am not confused about the message of Narcotics Anonymous, because the literature tells me that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. And it's okay with me today that I didn't get clean till I was 64. It's okay, you know, because I was thinking the other morning, you know, I was like, oh my God, I'm 68 years old. I've been through a lot of shit because in my addiction, I put myself in some very dangerous situations. And I know, y'all, I know that there were times when I was in mortal danger and I was too loaded, too out of my head to even be aware of. And yet I was kept safe. I survived 2 really serious car wrecks. You know, doing opiates and benzodiazepines is never a good idea. Never a good idea. In June of 96, I was driving a tiny little car and I got airborne and hit a tree and ended up in the hospital in the emergency room at St. Francis. And in January of 2001, I jumped a median going down south, get well, hit a car head on, and came to in the emergency room. Now, that time when I came to, I sat up and I was handcuffed to a stretcher. My belligerent ass, I was like, what's this shit? The nurse came over and said, you're under arrest. I said, what for? For DUI. I said, I haven't been drinking. She said, I know, but we know you've been doing something. I didn't know until the next day. Now they put me in the jail ward. I had a closed head injury, broken left collarbone, 7 broken ribs, lacerated left knee, and broken left ankle. I was tore up. And when it came time for me to be released from the hospital, my parents had moved out to Oakland, Tennessee. And of course I called, you know, to see if I could come there and convalesce, because the night that I had the wreck, y'all, I had all my stuff packed. It was in the back seat of my car because I was going to treatment the next morning. I was going to Samaritan Recovery in Nashville the very next morning. And guess what? Like a good old dope fiend, I was going to go get one more. Just one more. And that one more damn near killed me. So I called, and my mom said, you know, your brothers have told us that we're not to let you come back. We're not to let you, you know, you cannot come here. So I actually, I don't know if any of y'all remember that broken down old Shelby motel that used to be on Shelby Drive next to the interstate. I was there convalescing for about 3 weeks. And this is the length to which I would go. After my pain pills that the doctor gave me after they ran out, I called the dope man, told him where I was. He says, Paula, that place is hot. You're going to have to come down the street. There I am now. I got 7 broken ribs, a head injury, got cast on my left. Honey, I duct taped a plastic bag over that cast on my left foot, got all bundled up and hobbled down those 3 flights of steps and a block and a half down the street. And when dude saw me, he said, damn, Paula, what happened? I said, man, I told you I was all busted up. And he felt so sorry for me, he put me in the car and took me back to the motel. But the bottom line is, y'all, the past, okay, I looked it up, it's like 41 months and a few days, okay. I have been, because you know what? I was so ready to get clean, to do whatever you folks told me I had to do. If you had told me I got to swallow a bunch of frogs to get clean, I'd have said, give me the biggest sumbitch first and let's get this party started. Because I've discovered that just wanting to be clean was not enough for me. I had to be willing to do whatever it took. And I was willing because I had gotten that gift of desperation. So I got busy. I got a home group. I invested in the literature. I got a sponsor, you know, and I got busy. I started doing service work, you know. And like I said before, discovering all that stuff about myself, about how totally selfish and self-centered I was, about the fears that I didn't even know I had, you know. And I'm just made a commitment, y'all, because I was like Popeye. You know, when Popeye said, that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more. That was me. I had all the fun I could stand. And in fact, you know, that phrase, the good old days, man, I couldn't even remember the good old days. It had been a long time since doing dope was fun for me. You know, a long time. And I'm going to tell you, I'll share this with you and then I'll shut up. So far, the greatest gift that I've gotten in my recovery was the last 27 months of my precious mother's life when I was able to be there for her. Fully present, physically, mentally, and emotionally, and spiritually. Fully present for her, in her life, doing things for her, comforting her, getting up on the bed and spooning with her, you know. And going to the hospital with her and being there for her and being at the hospice as she died in my arms. Mm-hmm. October 21st of 2020 at 1:20 in the afternoon. And it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. All her wrinkles disappeared and her face was glowing. And I had her right here, y'all, and I was so in awe of what was going on. I could not speak or move. I don't think I was hardly breathing. I was just like, oh my God, look at this, look at this. And then not too long after that, the 2 of the nurses from the hospice came in and they probably thought I was out of my ever loving mind because I was just so buoyant and so relieved and in such a state. I said, oh my God, it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. You know, I wish it was a miracle, you know. And after that, people would ask me, how are you? How are you? I said, girl, I'm good. I'm good. You know, I'm okay. And because I'm a member of the No Matter What Club, no matter what happens in my life, I just don't pick up. I recently quit smoking after a little over 20 years. And you know what? I had tried the gum. I tried the patches, which, by the way, you can smoke with a patch on and it will not cause a heart attack. I tried the lozenges, and I even with some hesitation, tried that Chantix, you know, because I know people get real, some people get real crazy on that Chantix, but after 21 days of Chantix, when I was still wanting to talk, I just threw it away. So you know what I did? I started working the steps. I said, I am powerless over nicotine. It is making my life unmanageable. Because I was like at night checking to see how many I had. Do I need to stop at the store on the way home? Have I got enough to last? Do I need to go re-up? No. So I use the steps. I'm a member of the No Matter What Club. I just don't pick up no matter what. I've been blessed with a job that I absolutely love. Now, it is not without its issues. There's no perfect job, no perfect relationship, no perfect anything in the human realm, but I enjoy it. And the people that I work, it's a small organization. There's only 7 of us, but everybody that I work with is in recovery. And the 2 top dogs, they've been in recovery 35 years apiece, you know. And it's nice because if I'm having a bad day or I need to take a mental health day or I need to go to the back room and lay down and turn on some meditation music or whatever, they're like, go do what you got to do, you know. And last month, some of y'all heard the story about how God put me in a wonderful little duplex that I never dreamed that would happen, you know. Strictly a God thing, and it was fantastic, and I still can't believe it. I was sitting there in my house the other day, and a lot of times, y'all, I just get, when I think about where I've come from and all that I put myself through and everything that's been done for me and been given to me, the gratitude just leaks out of my eyes. I just sit there and just can't hardly believe it. And I was thinking the other day, you know, you're 68 years old. You had those 2 horrible car wrecks, blah, blah, blah. And I had this little aneurysm thing I had to have surgery for back in March. No big deal. And I've been treated for hepatitis C twice. I'm currently, you know, in remission. But I was thinking the only health problem you've got is, of course, your lipid profile is so jacked up. You know, I'm on that Lipitor stuff, you know, but I don't have high blood pressure. I don't have high diabetes. I have no after effects from either one of those car wrecks that I had. I really am. And I got a couple of brain cells left. And when they fire at the same time, y'all, hell on wheels. But I've been so blessed, you know.
Yes.
And how could I not be grateful? How could I not be happy, you know, to have the spiritual gifts that I've got? You know, the integrity and the self-respect and the ability to be accountable and responsible and a productive member of society today. And I have, you know, physical comforts. How could I not be grateful? How could I not be grateful? And how could I not show up to see you wonderful people when somebody asked me to give back to the fellowship that has been so good to me? How could I not? So thank you so much for being here, and that's all I got.